Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The unconfirmed reports are coming out of Libya fast and furious that Muammar Gaddafi is dead. With this news, one of the most brutal and strangest regimes of the modern era has come to an end. One more domino down in the Arab Spring. Almost certainly good news for Libyans, for Europe, NATO, and more. This hour on Point, the fall of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Before we dig deeper, let's go to Vivian Walt. She's Time Magazine correspondent in Tripoli. Vivian, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
There are various unconfirmed reports of how all of this went down, Vivian. As we come to air now, what is the latest information you have?
Well, I did speak to the head of the media of the National Transitional Council, was with him when he spoke to his people in search, who then confirmed certainly that Gaddafi is dead. There are still unconfirmed reports about the fate of his son, Saif al-Islam, and we'll wait to see where he is and if he is alive or dead. It's been always thought that Saif was very close by his father's side.
There are so many reports that Colonel Gaddafi was shot in the leg at first, then in the head. There was an exchange of fire, that he was not killed right away, that perhaps he died while he was being transported in an ambulance. Can you give us any more detail about that?
I think it is impossible at this point, given the level of rumors that fly around Libya, and we know that a number of reports have found to be untrue in the past. It's impossible to nail down these details fully, and we'll have to wait and see in the next few days. But certainly it does appear that his body has been moved out of Sirte to the nearby city of Misrata. You'll recall that was under siege for months. And the latest word is that they do not want to move his body to Tripoli. I think there's obviously a concern that he will in some way become a kind of martyr after his death.
There are reports, Vivian, that NATO airplanes struck a convoy or a site where Gaddafi was allegedly holed up before this exchange of gunfire, before he was taken and or killed. Can you confirm that? What do you know about that?
I can't confirm it, but that has been a story that filtered out fairly early this morning. We began hearing reports that Sirte was about to fall, and then fairly shortly after that, there was a report that NATO had bombed a convoy leaving Sirte, and there were at least two or three reports that came out as to that effect, and it appeared to certainly involve Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, if not his father. It was only really at around 2 o'clock this afternoon, Tripoli time, that's about 2 hours ago, that it really became clear that Gaddafi was dead. And, of course, the city has gone completely wild, as you can imagine.
Well, tell me about that. That was my next question. You're in Tripoli. What is the reaction there? What are you seeing?
It is really quite extraordinary. I'm in the center of Tripoli. The din is rather deafening. There have been car horns blaring for about 2 hours nonstop. There's very heavy gunfire in the air. I don't know if you can hear that in the background.
Yes.
And in the port, all the ships have been blaring their horns for hours in celebration. There's prayers being blasting out from all of the mosques, praising Allah for the victory. And really, I've seen in countless people just essentially collapse, overwhelmed with emotion, just hardly able to believe their eyes as they've watched television, throwing their arms around each other, congratulating each other. And even though the city has been in the hands of the rebel council for 2 months now, this really felt like unfinished business. This is perhaps the most historic moment in Libya, I would think, since Gaddafi took power 42 years ago.
So this unfinished business, I mean, describe more what this moment means for Libyans. Obviously, it's a moment of optimism. People are celebrating. But what does this mean for people moving forward?
Well, look, there really are practical implications to Gaddafi's death. It means that the council, that is this temporary council that has run Libya for the past 2 months, can now form a real temporary government. And that means that they can get funds unfrozen on the international markets. They can go out and make proper international oil deals. They can appeal to investors to come in and rebuild the country. None of that has begun yet, certainly around Tripoli. There's a little bit in the east around Benghazi, but Tripoli has been a city essentially frozen in time. There has not been a single business thing of business done here since February, and the country really is in the state of limbo, which effectively can now end. They will likely declare the war officially over now. And the next big step, of course, is to disarm all these militia and to get everybody to essentially unite in the national army.
So will the Libyan Transitional Council that you made reference to, is that council set, or will the composition of it change moving forward after this?
They have always said that the moment that the war is over, which I am imagining is today, they will announce a temporary government. There's been a lot of political moves in the last few days about who will stay and who will go, as they've readied themselves for a moment in which turf will fall, Gaddafi's hometown. The fact that Gaddafi is now dead, of course, makes this all the more urgent. They're already in the future, if you like. We're expecting, I'm sitting here actually at a hotel in downtown Tripoli, waiting for this prime minister to arrive, and he will address us within the next half an hour, apparently. And we are all expecting that this is what he will announce, that the council will be disbanded, there will be a real government now.
Might this also mean, Vivian, that NATO military operations might be coming to an end in Libya?
Well, that will be, of course, something to watch out of Brussels, but essentially, it will be hard to justify continuing a NATO campaign once CERT is gone. There's no sign left of a Gaddafi insurgency. This is not Iraq in 2003. Libya has really changed hands, if you like. CERT was the last holdout. And I would be surprised if NATO continued its military campaign for much longer. I would think a number of members will want to wrap it up pretty quickly. I did just run into a Syrian opposition politician in Tripoli who clearly is watching what implications this will have in Syria. And he thought that Bashar al-Assad, the dictatorial leader there, would not be sleeping very well tonight.
Mm-hmm. Right. We'll talk about the implications in Syria and beyond throughout the Middle East in this hour. Vivian Walt, Time Magazine correspondent in Tripoli. I so appreciate you taking the time for us today, Vivian. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Joining me now from Washington is Robin Wright, longtime Middle East watcher and reporter, currently a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Her recent book, which she researched and wrote before the Arab Spring unfolded, is called Rock the Kasbah. So nice to have you with us, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So how do you view this moment, these unconfirmed reports of the death of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi?
Well, he's effectively been out of power since August 22nd when he was forced to flee from Tripoli and the National Transition Council began to try to assume control not just of the eastern part of the country but the entire nation. But this is clearly the most important turning point for Libya and also for the next phase of the uprisings across the Middle East. This gives the Libyan people who have been struggling since the spring, the first opportunity to actually begin to get back on their feet in a way that has some tangible lasting effect. Before, it's all been piecemeal, band-aids, and this allows them to redefine their nation again. But it also, on a broader level, is going to embolden, energize the uprisings elsewhere. Now you have three leaders who have officially been ousted from power. And whether it's Bashar Assad in Syria or President Ali Saleh in Yemen, and frankly, virtually every leader in the region, there will be a sense that you have to accommodate the will of your people or else you were going to face some kind of consequence. And this is, it proves itself also as a wave of change that is historic in scope.
Over the last four decades, Gaddafi went from revolutionary hero to international pariah to strategic partner to pariah again. Before we go to our first break here, help us understand the significance of Gaddafi's rule in Libya.
Well, Gaddafi ousted a monarchy, and he was initially welcomed because he was seen as a man of the people who had the interest not just of an elite, but of the entire nation in what he wanted to do. And the various World Bank reports do note that, you know, whether it was the number of houses or shortwave radios and televisions or just the standard of living increased across the board. But he also became, frankly, very erratic in his behavior toward the outside world and his own people. He became increasingly draconian in repressing any challenge. He created a kind of loopy political system that was based on committees, but in which he really was the sole power. And he tried to resurrect his career after he got in trouble over the downing in 1988 of the Pan Am 103 flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, which killed everyone on board and some on the ground. And he did that by working with the international community on issues of weapons of mass destruction. But he never did anything to improve the situation at home. And that's where he ultimately was held to account by his own people with the support of the international community.
We're talking about the news out of Libya that the fall of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi is one step more complete, with news today that he was killed this morning by rebel forces in or near the city of Sirte. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about today's reports that Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi is dead. My guest this hour is Robin Wright, senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, a journalist and scholar who has covered the Middle East for a long time and whose latest book about the Arab Spring is Rock the Casbah. Joining me now from Germantown, Maryland is Naeem Gerinahi, a longtime Libyan-American dissident. It's so nice to have you with us, Naeem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell me your reaction today as you watch this news unfold.
Well, it's a very exciting moment. Of course, this is a moment that the Libyan people have been waiting for a very long time, and they paid for by the lives of tens of thousands of their sons and children and daughters. I'm very happy for Libya and for the Libyan people.
Was the best outcome a Gaddafi capture or a Gaddafi death, as seems to be the case today?
I would think that probably Gaddafi killed is the best outcome. There's really no value added by capturing and trying Gaddafi. He has the potential to create a lot of problems if he survives. There is nothing that the Libyans need to know more than what they already know about Gaddafi from trying him. So I would think that it's best for everybody that he's gone.
Gaddafi was often referred to as the mad dog of the Middle East, and you don't need me to tell you of the stories of torture and lengthy jail terms without a fair trial, of executions and disappearances. Help us understand what life was like for the average Libyan under Colonel Gaddafi.
Well, I have not lived that life directly, except for the first, 10 years of his reign. I left Libya as a young man back in 1972 to study abroad. I went back to Libya a few times in the 70s, and that was it. But for all these years, we've been in close contact, of course, with our families and friends and colleagues in Libya, and we kept up with the situation there. And I did go back to Libya in the last couple months for the first time after about 31 years. The country over all these years has been devastated. I mean, the people as well as the infrastructure of the country. All sectors have totally collapsed: education, health, social institutions. There's no existence for civil society whatsoever. Gaddafi was everything in Libya over all these years. So Libyans were alienated, were marginalized, were in a state of despair, hopeless and helpless until, of course, this uprising started about 8 months ago.
And so as you've been watching this uprising, this rebel movement unfold these last few months, what have you been feeling as you've been watching from afar?
Well, it's very exciting times for us, especially the older generation who tried to oppose Gaddafi and tried to bring about a change using different means, political and otherwise, and we have not been successful. To see that this success comes through the younger generation that was brought up during Gaddafi times and have seen nothing but Gaddafi was kind of surprised to all of us. But we also were impressed by those young people, by their determination and resilience and how they managed this uprising in the absence of clear national leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Total surprise.
Naeem, would you go back to Libya now without Gaddafi in power?
I did go back, as I mentioned. I spent about 6 weeks there recently, and I'm planning to go back again, yes.
We appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for your perspective.
Thank you.
Naeem Gerani from Germantown, Maryland today. With me now is Ben Wiedemann from New York City, joining me, senior international correspondent for CNN. Ben, how nice to have you with us.
Yeah, hi, Jean.
So tell us your reaction today. What have you been seeing, the latest news from where you are?
Well, certainly this does represent a turning point for Libya. We have to remember that since February, things have been quite in an anarchic state as the revolution proceeded. And many people thought that with the fall of Tripoli back in August, that the end was near. But things became very complicated in towns like Beni Walid and Sirte down in the south. So certainly for many Libyans, the reports of the death of Muammar Gaddafi represent a certain amount of closure. But revolutions are always uncertain affairs. And this may be a turning point, but we don't know where it's turning to. Jane?
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Ben, made an unannounced trip to Tripoli just this week and pledged millions of dollars in new aid. I'm curious how you think Gaddafi's death might impact or change U.S. relations now with Libya.
I don't think it will. I think the Americans have adjusted their policy to Libya to the fact that sooner or later Muammar Gaddafi was going to leave the scene. Tripoli has been under the new regime's control since August, and it was really only a matter of time before eventually they would take Beni Walid, take Sirte, and eventually either kill or capture Muammar Gaddafi. And it's certainly interesting that Hillary Clinton, during her visit to Tripoli, did in fact say that she hoped that very soon Gaddafi would be either captured or killed. And certainly that this actually happened just a few days after her visit is interesting.
Mm. She and other senior U.S. officials have repeatedly stressed the importance of dealing with the stockpiles of Libyan weapons. What about that part of this story, Ben?
Yes, certainly. I saw quite a lot of those weapons scattered around Libya, surface-to-air missiles, landmines, Scud rockets, and it's going to be a gargantuan task. You have to realize it's a huge country, which over the years, certainly in the 70s and the 80s, spent billions of dollars on all this, to some extent, antiquated Soviet weaponry, and it really is scattered all over the country. And certainly since NATO began its air campaign back in March against Libya, a lot of that weaponry was dispersed around the country, in some areas just buried in remote parts of the country, and it seems that every other day they're discovering new caches of weapons. So they're going to need help from the United States to track all this stuff down and, in theory, destroy it.
Ben, how much over these last many months was Gaddafi able to accomplish in hiding, shoring up his loyalist forces, sending money out there to shore up his effort? How much was he able to accomplish while he was in hiding?
Well, certainly he did delay the eventual victory of the NTC forces by quite a lot. As I said, it was assumed after he fled Tripoli that the end was near, but the end has taken several more months. But it's also important to keep in mind that not everybody who has resisted the new regime in Tripoli is necessarily wildly enthusiastic about Muammar Gaddafi and his unique ideology. Many of these people are worried about retribution, about revenge, about the unruly nature of the rebel fighters themselves, who in many instances have looted, have ransacked, have burned homes and stolen property. This has been one of the reasons why people have put up a fight against the rebel fighters. Not necessarily that Muammar Gaddafi paid them or that they really actually had any love for him whatsoever.
Ben Wiedemann, senior international correspondent for CNN, is my guest this hour. Robin Wright, veteran journalist and Middle East analyst, senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, also with me. Let's go to the phones to our listeners. First in Chelmsford, Massachusetts, Kelly is on the line. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I visited Libya in 2006, right after the relationship with that country warmed up a little bit and sanctions were lifted. Mm-hmm. It is an amazing place and with a lot of beauty and a lot of potential. But I have a couple of cautionary points. The first is that it is a very poor place, and it's going to be up to the new leaders, I think, to try to redistribute the wealth to improve the infrastructure. I think your guest mentioned how much of it is in shambles right now. And the other point is, like, much like Yugoslavia with the death of Marshal Tito many, many years ago, I'm worried a little bit about the country kind of staying together because you have these factions in Benghazi and in the West that are different. I'm hopeful that the new government can actually keep the country together for the betterment of all. That's really about it. Thanks.
Kelly, thank you very much. Robin Wright, I'll turn those points to you. First, the redistribution of wealth in Libya after Gaddafi.
Well, the 22 Arab countries, I think Libya actually has, in many ways, a greater chance of making the transition anytime soon, in part because it has such a small population, roughly 6.5 million people, and a lot of oil wealth, compared with a place like Egypt, where Ben lives, where there are 85 million people and very limited natural resources, very reliant on foreign tourism that's kind of dried up in the aftermath of the uprising. So Libya has the key ingredients it takes to make the transition. But he's right in addressing the issue of the divisions within. This is a country that has been riven particularly between Benghazi in the east and Tripoli in the west, and has something like 140 tribes and clans, 30 of which are important. And then there's the issue of the rival militias who have been going after the regime from different points in the country and all want their rewards, all want to guarantee that they're players in the new Libya, and may not be willing down to the man to hand over their arms all that quickly.
Ben Wiedemann, what about that point, holding Libya together?
Now, certainly, I think one of the problems that has come out over the course of this rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi is that many of the fighters have now gotten their hands on weapons and are not going to give them up easily. In fact, I saw in places like Beni Walid and Sebha that there was sort of a scramble to get to the arsenals, get your hands on weapons, because weapons in the aftermath will guarantee a place for you at the table when it comes to dividing the power. So this, I think, could be one of the main problems, is these regional divisions. And I've always been surprised by how in each little town and village and city, there's very much a mentality of, you know, we're from Misrata, or we're from Zintan, we're from Benghazi. And there's not a great willingness to sort of say, okay, now we're all Libyans, let's make a government together.
Let's go back to the phones. Boston is where Mohammed is calling from. Mohammed, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm so happy that they came today. They killed him today because he was really a bad man, and he was one of the dictator that, you know, he caused a lot of problems all over the world, including the Western countries, the Arabic countries. I am from Morocco, mm-hmm. and he is the one who support Polisario for a long time, and also he is the enemy for to everybody, even the one that they said that he is the their for example his friends. They are not really their friends, but they are scared from him because he can invest a lot of money.
So being from Morocco, Mohammed, you think this is a good thing for the future of North Africa?
Yeah, of course, for the peace in Africa, because the Polisario, they got a lot of money from him and they got a lot of weapons from him. Mm-hmm. So this support doesn't push them to talk about the peace in the in North Africa.
I got it, Mohammed. Thanks for calling. Our time is short. Let me turn to Robin Wright and ask, do you agree? Is this good for North Africa? And what does this mean for Europe?
Oh, I think it's, of course, any kind of political change that opens up political systems, particularly in the last block of countries to hold out against the democratic tide, is important. It's far from over. This is the beginning of a very, very long process. Muammar Gaddafi did symbolize not only a man who was dangerous to his own people, but who supported the most radical groups in not only the region, but in the world. A number of times I was in Tripoli dating back to 1980 when there were representatives of groups from, you know, the IRA to the radical Palestinians present in Tripoli doing business with Gaddafi. So, yes, it's a turning point in terms of the atmospherics in the region. And the mere fact that you're seeing so many people demanding an end to dictatorship, and in most countries, a process that began with peaceful civil disobedience, and that in all three North African countries, you're seeing it was the people's will, the people's initiative that ended up playing the critical role in ousting men who'd been in power a quarter century or more.
Here's another call on that point from David in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Gene.
Hi.
Concerning the fall of Gaddafi's government, this has got to be said. It is not necessarily a good thing because he has cooperated the last 5 years on the illegal alien issue, and we could have a flood of illegal aliens going into Europe as a result of the fall of his government, because once he's gone, there's not going to be law and order. There's going to be no law and disorder. Europe has to watch out. He has helped to keep the prices of oil down, and I just don't buy this thing that he's all bad and the people that are against him are all good people.
David, thank you. Ben Wiedemann, there's another point of view. What about that?
Well, I think on the question of illegal immigration to Europe, Gaddafi's position was not necessarily all that positive. All indications were that, in fact, he used that as a tool against Europe, and in exchange, it got money, got influence and whatnot. So that's not necessarily going to be such a bad thing, getting rid of him on that issue. On the question of law and order, what I saw in places like Benghazi and Misrata, that the revolutionary forces were surprisingly good at reestablishing law and order very quickly. No banks were looted. The only institutions or buildings that were burnt or destroyed, by and large, were those related to the intelligence, the police, and the army. So unlike, for instance, in post-Saddam Iraq, you didn't have this massive looting of every single government building and institution. This new regime in Tripoli, with notable exceptions, has by and large been fairly successful, given the circumstances, at maintaining a level of law and order.
Ben Wiedemann is my guest, senior international correspondent for CNN. Robin Wright, veteran journalist and Middle East analyst. We're talking about today's reports of the death of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the death of Libyan dictator Colonel Muammar Gaddafi this hour and what it means for Libya and for the broader Arab Spring. Here's some sound, chanting, honking of horns, celebratory gunfire today as revolutionaries overrun the last positions of Muammar Gaddafi and his forces insert. That is CERT. Libya this morning. Let's go back to the phones. Here's Boston, Jared on the line. Jared, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Oh, I just kind of wanted to respond to a previous caller and maybe some other sentiment out there about, you know, how Gaddafi might not have been all bad. And that is just to remind everyone that he was very directly involved in the bombing of Pan Am 103 and the number of Americans and Europeans that were killed in that. I went to Syracuse University where our foreign exchange students were on that plane, and you know, he killed, I believe, 36 Syracuse University students. And his suffering, the pain and suffering he caused, was not limited to Libya or North Africa, but it's something that very directly touched Americans as well. And I think that trying to say he wasn't all that bad or, you know, helped keep the price of oil down is really misremembering very important history and pain that he caused upon people.
Jared, I'm glad you called, and thanks for bringing that up. Robin Wright, of course, Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Take us back. Remind us of that moment in history.
Well, this was a very traumatic moment. This was a plane filled with largely American citizens en route from Europe to the United States, and it was bombed over this Scottish town and came down in horrible chunks, created a real trauma because this was the first time the United States had faced something like this. Even though Muammar Gaddafi had done it earlier with a French UTA aircraft about a year earlier, and it was at this moment that the United States had to struggle to figure out who was involved. It was so cleverly orchestrated that it took almost 2 years before they got it down to a tiny little piece from the bomb that helped them track it to the UTA aircraft and then Libyan intelligence. There were originally some theories about whether Syria, Iran, and other nations had been involved, and it took a long time to refocus attention on Libya.
Was there ever U.S. or international military retaliation against Libya, against Gaddafi for that bombing?
Well, there had been, remember, after the bombing of a disco in Germany where U.S.
Right. In 1986,
had
right?
hung out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the moment that the more important step was mobilizing the international community to act against Gaddafi for this bombing, particularly in the light of two aircraft that had been brought down. And this was a moment that the squeeze began, and it was that squeeze that cut him off from everything that eventually led him to cooperate with the international community several years later on weapons of mass destruction and handing over information about his nuclear, you know, and other deadly weapons, as well as collaborating on terrorism issues.
Ben Wiedemann, over the years, Colonel Gaddafi made countless show-stopping appearances at Arab and other international gatherings with his outlandish clothing, his long diatribes, his unconventional behavior, to put it mildly. We remember, of course, Gaddafi's appearance at the 2009 General Assembly, where his speech rambled on for over an hour. He tore up pages of the UN Charter as he spoke. Give us a historical perspective or remembrance of kind of his antics over the years.
Well, certainly he came into power at a fairly young age, just 27, when he led a coup on the 1st of September 1969. And his behavior got increasingly odd over the years. Certainly he didn't really ever gain much popularity in the Arab world because of his antics. And at various Arab summits, he was fairly insulting to other Arab leaders. In the 2003, there was a summit, an Arab summit right before the beginning of the Iraq war, where he accused the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf of being American stooges. And he was involved, for instance, in a plot, or his intelligence was involved in a plot to try to kill the king of Saudi Arabia. So he was certainly a flamboyant figure who really didn't have much of a popular following. And I've met him on various occasions, and I was always struck by how strange his behavior was. I once met him in his tent outside of Sirte, his hometown, and I noticed that he was wearing the same T-shirt that he was wearing in the newspaper the day before. And certainly just looking in his eyes, he didn't seem to be He seemed to be under some sort of medication. So a very strange man who left a very odd impression on many people.
Strange. You've met him. You've spoken with him. Other than the fact that he did have odd behavior, did he seem intelligent, resourceful, educated? What were your other impressions?
He sort of put out this aura of sort of he would ramble on and mumble. And he didn't always make a lot of sense. You would interview him and then go back and look at the tape and realize he didn't make an awful lot of sense. But I think his problem was he was the people around him, everything he said was either incredibly intelligent or incredibly witty. So he was constantly reinforced by the people around him. And I don't think he had many people close to him who would say, Mahmud, I think you sound like a lunatic. And I think that may have been, you know, part of his downfall, that nobody ever told him you've gone too far.
Robin Wright, he also lived with a good deal of paranoia. I heard this morning, with all that money, this was a man that was still never slept two nights in a row in the same place.
Well, that's true of many Middle East dictators or people who are under pressure right now. Let me add something to what Ben said. You know, when I interviewed him in the early days of his career, I was struck by the fact that this is the son of a Bedouin sheepherder who had worked his way into power at a very young age. He was only in his late 20s when he took over, who was and not well educated by classic standards, but who actually was, I thought, rather shrewd. I think he deteriorated steadily over the years, and whatever medical condition he had, it was clear that in the later years that he was under some kind of medication, that the kind of loopiness had grown far more severe. But I don't think that he was a stupid man, and in many ways had some interesting ideas about, in the early days of his political career, of trying to do better, at least economically, for the people of Libya. But he clearly became, as he was widely known, the madman of the Middle East.
Here's a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Ahmed is on the line. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I want to mention that African migrants pretty much violated their rights, and I wish when Madam Clinton, when they put pressure on this new regime in Tripoli to respect the human rights of these African migrants.
More human rights respect. Ahmed, thank you. Here's another call from Boston. Ifosa, you're on the line. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, how are you doing, please?
Fine, go ahead.
Yeah, what I was saying earlier is this. You know, when you look at the whole African continent, you can see that what Dama has done a lot of good, and he has done a lot of bad. But if we continue to point on the scene alone, but who is the sinner here? We continue to say he's a sinner, but why don't we blame the sin himself? You know, look at this. The way the man was disposed this morning and killed, it's wrong. It's wrong. He should have been arrested and prosecuted.
Erfosa, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Robin Wright, let me turn to you. I mean, I am curious how a man with so much power and so much money and so many weapons and so many loyalists, how is it that he ends up like this, you know, in a hole somewhere, hiding out and hunted down?
Well, 42 years of corrupt, abusive rule does that to a leader. I mean, this is the phenomena across the Middle East, that we're seeing challenges to the autocratic, the geriatric autocrats who've ruled the region now for such a long time. The more the abusive, the more challenges they face, despite the fact they have extraordinary power and extraordinary wealth. You're seeing a man like Bashar Assad in Syria facing the same kind of challenges. I mean, this is the country that that I think surprises many of us who have been following the Middle East for so many years, that even the regime in Damascus is facing repeated and resilient protests by millions of people across the country. Yes, it takes a long time, but the mere fact that they're continuing is stunning. And I think the perseverance of the Libyans, despite Gaddafi's willingness to use every weapon at his disposal is telling.
Ben Wiedemann, as you know, Colonel Gaddafi took his anti-imperialist campaign around the world. He funded, supported militant groups and resistance movements wherever he found them. He also targeted Libyan exiles, dozens of whom were apparently killed by assassins believed to belong to this global Libyan intelligence network. I mean, what happens now to so many of these loyalists and so much of this web that Muammar Gaddafi built?
Well, I think that's one of the main worries, is that where are these people going to go? What are they going to do? It's worth noting that a lot of the people, in fact, who are part of the new regime in Tripoli did play a role in part of that network. So the hope is, I think, in Tripoli is that somehow, you know, the excesses will be, they'll put an end to the excesses, and somehow they'll be able to incorporate peacefully all of those people who were part of the old regime. I think the worry is that there's going to be a lot of revenge killing, that there will be people who want to push either just a campaign to completely purify the administration of all elements of the old regime. And I think they're looking at a place, at a country like Egypt right next door, where, yes, Hosni Mubarak, the head of the regime, has been removed, but the regime itself is very much still there in power and resistant to change. So I think it's going to be, it could be a couple messy months in Tripoli as they sort this legacy out.
Ben Wiedemann, senior international correspondent for CNN. I really appreciate your time today, Ben. Thanks. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Robin Wright, what about the possibility of the revenge killings that Ben Wiedemann just referred to now after Gaddafi?
Well, you have, you know, 4 decades of built up anger at the regime, and the danger is those who supported Gaddafi to the end, particularly in his hometown, I think face real challenges. And the danger is that some of these militias get out ahead of the government and do what they want rather than what, you know, either the international community or the national transition government wants. This is where you put the new power in Tripoli to the test. How much can it rein in these people? How much can it prevent revenge killing? And how do they exert their power as a national and legitimate group, not one that reflects the divisions of the country, but the unity of the country as it tries to, you know, elect a new government or write a new constitution? These are enormous challenges ahead.
Right. Here's another call. John from Stratford, Vermont. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane. Hey, obviously, this is a great victory for the Libyan people themselves, but isn't it also a unique foreign policy success for the Obama administration, and particularly Secretary Clinton? In this was almost a disaster years, you know, not that long ago when Benghazi was almost taken over. And yet we seem to have been able to craft a way, particularly difficult after our invasion of Iraq, to help out in a way that lets the Libyan people themselves claim ownership of the revolution.
John, our time is short. I appreciate your call. Robin Wright, do you see this as a foreign policy success for the United States, for the Obama administration?
I think it's an enormous policy success, and it stands in stark contrast to Iraq, where the United States basically went it alone against the wishes of many of our allies without a UN resolution and without Arab support. This is one where we began from, you know, by getting the 22 Arab countries behind us, then getting a United Nations resolution, and then mobilizing the world's most powerful military alliance to often take the lead on this. And so the cost of this operation was roughly 3 days of what we have spent in Iraq. And we managed to get rid of one of the most notorious dictators in the region with the face of the Libyan people on it. The fact is, the Libyan people probably could not have done this without NATO eroding the military strength of Colonel Gaddafi. But this is one that looks legitimate in the eyes of the Arab people.
wrap us up here. Big day, Robin Wright, with the apparent death of Muammar Gaddafi. I mean, what does this mean? We've talked so much about the details here. Just give us a broad stroke moving forward. What does this day imply for the weeks and months and years to come?
I think this is one of those big turning points, like the ouster of President Ben Ali in Tunisia first and then Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. The question obviously is who's next, and that's where the president of Yemen faces a real challenge. The leadership in Syria must be extremely uncomfortable today. But I think there are leaders across the region who, even though they didn't like Muammar Gaddafi either, are very nervous about what happens when people in their own countries mobilize, whether it's to act in peaceful civil disobedience or whether it's to take up arms against a regime also using force. That there are a lot of different messages out there, and they all seem to have a common theme, and that is this is a time of change.
Well, we will keep watching. Robin Wright, we so appreciate your expert view on this. Veteran journalist, Middle East analyst, senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, author of Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.